making music with the entire family.
Sometimes it wouldn't be so formal as we were all together in the kitchen singing in harmony. Sometimes it would be our dad was waiting for his bath to fill up, so he'd pull out his guitar and we'd all go into his bedroom and sing with him for the 5 minutes that it took his bath to fill up.
That's folk singer Katrina Neals. We'll talk with her and her sister Narissa about their terrific book and CD set, All Together Singing in the Kitchen. And how do you write great songs about the great issues of our time?
What always has to come first, in my opinion, is the songwriting. And it has to be, you have to be writing in a way that is convincing, like to have a voice that really works for that song. The style is always as important as content.
That's topical singer-songwriter David Rovics. We'll talk with him about his Songs of Social Significance. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When I was young, I spent many hours in the kitchen with my mother singing songs together as she prepared dinner. They were classics of American folk song and jazz. They taught me something about American history and forged a musical bond I still cherish. But nowadays, singing with the family is something of a lost tradition, with so many of us glued to our screens, parents and kids. Singer-songwriters Katrina and Narissa Neals are hoping to bring that tradition back with their new book and CD set, All Together Singing in the Kitchen, Creative Ways to Make and Listen to Music as a Family. Dar Williams said of the book, "This wonderful go-to book will help real people create not just musical opportunities, but a musical home." Narissa and Katrina Neals are national touring folk musicians. They've shared the stage with Pete Seeger, Arlo Guthrie, Suzanne Vega, and Joan Baez, among others. Narissa Neals and Katrina Neals, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you.
All Together Singing in the Kitchen. This is really a lovely book, and a book that seeks to revive an old tradition, traditions that seem to be falling away maybe ever since the rise of television. Talk a little bit about the traditions of singing in the family.
Oh, I love that question.
Narissa Neals.
In our family, we've been reading the Little House on the Prairie books, so I have been thinking a lot about this because, you know, in 19th century America and all over the world, people certainly didn't have television, but a lot of people didn't even have books, or the family maybe had two or three books. And a prized possession in the family would be the fiddle or the piano. You know, people saved up for years for an organ or a piano. And certainly singing was something that was free. Like, everybody could sing. And you know, I'm sure that they thought about people having nicer voices than other people, but you know, you didn't have this, like, well, I'm not really a singer. Like, if you could carry a tune at all, you were a singer. And how much the family looked forward to getting together to sing at the end of the day or at church or with their friends, and how songs were so special, and learning a new song was so special, and having a canon of songs that you sang with your family was so important.
Yeah, and you both grew up in, I mean, your family was a musical family. Talk a little bit about your family traditions.
Way back in the days before cable television. We grew up.
Katrina Neals.
And we had a dad who played the guitar. He played guitar, you know, he knew probably 8 chords. And with that, he could play anything we wanted to hear. And we had a record player, and he would sometimes play records on it, but mostly the music in our house was made by us. And my dad would bring his guitar out after supper or even before supper, and we'd all sit around the kitchen, and we'd sing songs. And he had a high tenor, and I had kind of a high voice, so I sang the melody along with him. But for Narissa, it was a little bit of a stretch, so she learned how to harmonize with our mom. And it was our way of being together as a family. And when we were little kids,
it was easy for our father and mother to get our attention because they had it incessantly. We didn't have their attention maybe all the time when they had to get things done, but they had ours anytime they wanted it. And the beauty of the music was that because we had knit ourselves together by singing together as a family when we were little kids, it remained when we became adolescents. And I remember making yearly trips to our local equivalent of Tanglewood to see Pete Seeger and Arlo Guthrie do their annual concert together. And it was our family tradition. We went together. And just as watching a sporting event makes you want to go out on the front yard and play catch, going to a concert made our family want to go home and pull out the instruments and sing together. And, oh, I hadn't thought about Jacob's Ladder in 6 years. Let's sing that together because Pete and Arlo sang it last night. And it was how we related to each other. And it still is to this day. You know, when we gather with our family, we pull out the guitars and sing.
Now, did you do this on like a weekly or daily or monthly basis?
I would say almost daily.
Really?
Yeah. It depended on our dad's work schedule. And, you know, as we got older, it probably didn't happen as often. And on vacation, it happened almost every night. And, you know, sometimes it wouldn't be so formal as we were all together in the kitchen singing in harmony. Sometimes it would be our dad was waiting for his bath to fill up, so he'd pull out his guitar and we'd all go into his bedroom and sing with him for the 5 minutes that it took his bath to fill up. And that would be it, you know. But it was something. And when we would drive together in the car, all we had was AM radio. So it was either the station was playing music that we liked, or we'd have to turn it off and make our own music.
That's great. Now, singing in the kitchen, why the kitchen?
That's where we, I mean, I think most families end up in the kitchen, don't you? I mean, it's sort of where the action was happening. And literally, the title comes from a song that my dad sang that he probably heard once or twice on the radio and appropriated for his own uses. It's a Bobby Bear song, but it's actually a Shel Silverstein lyric that comes out very differently in the original. My father sort of changed it. And he would sing, all together singing in the kitchen, all together singing in the kitchen. And then he would add our names. So Narissa and Katrina are singing in the kitchen together with the pots and the pans.
Could you sing it?
Sure.
That was wonderful. So now, in terms of singing in the kitchen, talk about a family canon. Now, I can remember my mother had, she was the one who transmitted the canon on to me, which I'm working on with my granddaughter. But funnily enough, you know, it feels to me that there's a lot I don't remember. You know, the words I don't remember, I have to kind of fill in. And a lot of what my mother also taught me was, you know, the one that I remember the most was, maybe I can sing it now. My granddaughter loves this. She's 7 years old. She loves this song, but it's a very gory song. And it's, do you ever hear of this one, Blood on the Saddle?
No. How does it go? Sing it for
us. Okay. I'm not a very good singer, but. There was blood on the saddle, there was blood on the ground, and a great big puddle of blood all around. The cowboy lay in it, all covered with gore. He won't go cowpunching, never no more.
Wow. You know, there's another cowboy song that our dad sang to us all about this cowboy who's dead, The Streets of Laredo. It's a pretty famous song. You might know it. And I remember, you know, he sang it to me all my life. And when I hit the age of 7, I understood it and I started bawling. But before 7, I just thought it was like an interesting, nice song. You know, it's like, it's so interesting to see where kids' consciousnesses catch up to the lyrics and the meaning of various songs. And I think that's such a wonderful thing about family music, is to maintain the sad and serious songs. You know, like, it's a sort of an adult projection to think that kids are going to take in all the meanings, you know, but
or that they can't handle it.
Yeah, that they can't handle all the emotions that go along with life. I think it's really important to expose them to life.
Well, this was exactly why I asked you that question. You know, House of the Rising Sun was another one that my mother sang to me. I mean, what did I know of prostitution? I certainly didn't. You know, is it okay to pass these songs on to children, and do you want to talk to them? Do you want to explain it, or do you just want to sing the song?
I think that depends on the kid. I think that depends on the questions being asked. I feel the same way about sex education, actually. I heard this great study long ago where a bunch of parents and a bunch of kids were interviewed about when kids should be taught sex education, and the parents all had, you know, in fourth grade, in sixth grade, when they're 7, when they're 10, when they're 15, they had very precise ideas about when that should happen. And the kids' answers were all, when we ask.
Mm. And I think it's the same with what you're talking about. And it reminds me of the great work that Joseph Campbell did with mythology. You know, like that these myths, these stories, these cultural legends, they're just there, and they're part of our heritage, and we can enter them at whatever level we're at and get something different out of them, or get what's appropriate. We can go into the forest of the myth and bring back whatever we need to nourish us at that given age, at that given time.
Well, that's just such a wonderful answer. What about families who aren't musically inclined?
Ah, glad you asked. What a good question.
Well, first of all, no one is really devoid of music, you know, and the number of people who are actually tone deaf is about the same number of people who are colorblind. Mm-hmm. So it's really not very common. It's something that I think we shy away from. When you think about school-age kids, 99% of them sing all the time. Back the school bus, in the middle of a spelling test, they sing the same way they draw. It's just part of their expression. And the fact that we start to censor ourselves as we get older is a shame. Mm-hmm. So mostly we think, you know, we begin the book with a quotation that's, if you can walk, you can dance. If you can talk, you can sing. And we definitely believe that. On the other hand, there are those people who feel like, but I just can't sing to my child. And if you really feel like singing and playing an instrument are not for you, there's also a whole bunch in this book about listening. Mm-hmm. And wonderful ways that you can bring music into your family, even if that's about listening.
And we're talking with Narissa Neils and Katrina Neils, that was Katrina just speaking, about their book, All Together, Singing in the Kitchen, Creative Ways to Make and Listen to Music as a Family. Narissa.
Well, I was going to say, regardless of talent, there are some people who I think of as incredibly musical. And they don't necessarily sing, and they don't necessarily play an instrument, but music is their passion, and they are listeners. They love, you know, and some of us cross both, you know, are in both camps. We love to listen, and we love to perform and sing. But I know a lot of people who that is their way they express themselves, is to make mixes, is to play DJ, is to pick their favorite songs, create, you know, like, oh, I think I'm going to make a mix of all my favorite autumn songs and put that together in a creative format where the songs seem to, like, weave into each other in a beautiful way. And we have a lot in this book that's about interacting with your kids around the music that they listen to, because I actually think that's one of the most important ways that you can bridge the gaps that inevitably happen in family life, you know, where suddenly you feel like you're just not communicating with your kid the same way you used to. as the kids get older and they discover their own interests. And one of the things we talk about is when kids start to listen to music that maybe you don't like, or and you take it personally, and you want to convert them back to whatever your kind of music was, and ways that you can kind of share with each other around that and say, try to listen to your kids' music with an ear to, what do I relate to? What do I have in common with this? What does this remind me of from my childhood? What are some of the bad bands that I listened to in the 80s that I loved then but maybe don't love now, but maybe I can try to remember, what was it in me that really loved that, and what do I see in my kid that's loving this other music that I right now can't relate to, but maybe I could? So there are all sorts of creative ways to use music as a bridge and a glue and a universal language that mm-hmm. it is.
That was Narissa Neilds. We're talking with her and her sister Katrina about their wonderful book and CD set, All Together Singing in the Kitchen. It's about making music together as a family and is chock full of suggestions about how to get the musical juices flowing. The book comes with a CD that has a wide selection of songs for all ages. Here's one of them, John the Rabbit.
Oh, John the Rabbit, yes, got a mighty habit, yes, jumping in my garden, yes, cutting down my cabbage, yes, my sweet potatoes, yes, my fresh tomatoes.
Also have a CD in this book. What I liked about it is that it seemed to have a range of music. Is it your family's musical canon that's in this book?
Well, the CD is all songs that are either written by us or in the public domain. So it's a kind of a, it, I wouldn't call it a snapshot of our family musical canon at all. It's really more a teaching tool to go along with the book. In the book, there are a lot of songs with guitar chords, and there are also a lot of games and a lot of songs for teaching in all sorts of different ways. And we wanted to demonstrate orally what we were saying on the written page. Mm-hmm. So that's really the function of the CD. But I have to tell you, it's been on our CD changer, and my kids are very much enjoying it, and I don't mind it so much myself.
Yeah, and what I liked about it is that it seems to have a range of songs, songs that appeal to a range of ages. I mean, there are some for the very young. You know, I know that if I play them for my granddaughter, she's going to say, that's for babies. Mm-hmm. But then there are other songs that I know that she's going to join right into. Maybe for older kids, not so much. Is that true?
Well, I have a 10-year-old, and I would say that some of these songs will feel like, I mean, some of them are actually for babies. The Itsy Bitsy Spider is in it. So she would only interact with the Itsy Bitsy Spider if she were trying to entertain one of her little cousins. But there are definitely songs in this book and even on the CD that I think of as grown-up songs.
Well, that's like, true. The Saints Go Marching In.
And Wild Mountain Time. Mm-hmm. And to me, for a while, and I even wrote about this in the book, I feared that when my daughter got older and she left behind the folk music that is my livelihood, that I would feel separated from her, that we would be apart. And it hasn't, for her at least, the fact that she loves Lady Gaga and Katy Perry and Adele doesn't mean that she doesn't also love When the Saints Go Marching In and Mozart and and Wild Mountain Time or music that I make. She's able to like all of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you define music as being for a certain age group, you limit anybody's ability to interact with it. And I guess I find more that there are individual songs that kids just don't like or they do like. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really, especially with folk music, which is so elastic and so appealing to, you know, generations and generations of people, you know, somebody might just really not like When the Saints Go Marching In. And it isn't about the fact that that isn't for the right age group. It's just not a song they like.
Right.
Just
it's personal.
Like
personal
they maybe, my daughter doesn't like Justin Bieber. Most of the world likes Justin Bieber, but she doesn't. So I try to keep all of the different kinds of music alive in our house and in my car. I listen to their radio station that they most like, but the rule is if there's too much auto-tune, I get to change the channel. Mm-hmm. And they agree with me. So, and then, you know, they'll listen to a CD that I like, or we'll turn off the radio and sing together, or we'll listen to a radio station that has music that I like. And sometimes they'll discover something on there that they never would have heard before.
And you also have ways in this book of children and parents making up their own music.
Yeah, that's a big discovery. I feel like Katrina taught me this, that when we were creating Hootenanny, which is a parent child baby music program that we've been running for the past 5 years, she taught me that you can take just about any song and expand it, and you know, throw in whatever you want. I was actually just in a toy store yesterday listening to the soundtrack they were playing, and I wish I could tell you who it was. It was great. But it was a version of The Wheels on the Bus Go Round and Round, and the band was just going, and the dinosaur on the bus goes, rah, 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 you know. Like,
it's Primate Fiasco.
Oh, it's Primate Fiasco. Wonderful. Wonderful. Our friends and fellow band players.
Primate
Fiasco. Yeah, just, you know, and sort of taking that creativity and applying it to other songs. It's sort of like the art of collage making, you know, like cutting things out that you like and pasting them in. And it's definitely a modern way of approaching music. It's certainly, you know, prevalent in the hip-hop world, too. But just, you know, like taking any song and kind of making it your own, putting patches on it and dressing it up.
I work with I volunteer in my kids' school to do music and try to have a monthly all-school sing-along. And one of the things that music is beautiful for is for doing tributes to the people who are who need to be celebrated. And at the school last spring, the school nurse retired after decades of service. And I sat down with the fourth grade class and we chose a Beatles song to rewrite, and the kids all came up with ideas for how they could add to this song and thank this nurse for having taken such good care of them for their school career thus far. And, you know, it's an incredibly simple thing to replace words in a song, and it makes the kids feel like songwriters. It makes them feel like they own the song. If they didn't like the song before, they end up loving it because they were the ones that made up the words. It's a really cool and empowering thing to give to, I think, all age kids and grown-ups.
Well, the book is All Together Singing in the Kitchen, Creative Ways to Make and Listen to Music as a Family. It's just been terrific to have you here, both Narissa and Katrina Neils. Thanks for coming on to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having us,
yeah,
Francesca.
Thank you.
In addition to All Together Singing in the Kitchen, Narissa and Katrina Neils have released 15 albums, including another family album. They also have a family music DVD titled Organic Farm. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to listen to or download their songs. Next up, Songs of Social Significance with David Rovix. Stay tuned.
Oh, all together, singing in the kitchen, all together, singing in the kitchen, all together, singing in the kitchen, together with the pots and the pans.
Oh, Nerissa and Katrina are
singing in the kitchen,
Nerissa and Katrina are singing in the kitchen, Nerissa and Katrina are singing in the kitchen,
together with the pots and the pans.
Oh, Amelia and her mama are
singing in the kitchen, Amelia and mama are singing in the kitchen, Amelia and mama are singing in the kitchen,
together with the pots and the pans.
Oh, Grammy and Granddaddy singing in the kitchen, Grammy and Granddaddy singing in the kitchen, Grammy and Granddaddy singing in the kitchen,
together with the pots and the pans.
Oh,
all together singing in the kitchen, all together singing in the kitchen, all together singing in the kitchen, together with the pots and the pans.
Oh, Dave plays bass singing in the kitchen,
Dave plays bass.
Together with the pots and the pans.
Oh, Nerissa and Tom are
singing in the kitchen.
Nerissa and Tom are singing in the kitchen. Nerissa and Tom are singing in the kitchen.
Together with the pots and the pans.
Oh,
all together singing in the kitchen. All together singing in the kitchen. All together singing in the kitchen. Together with the pots and the pans.
So John, Daddy, Granddaddy singing in the kitchen.
John, Daddy, Granddaddy singing in the kitchen. So John, Daddy, Granddaddy singing in the kitchen.
Together with the pots and the pans.
Oh, William sings a solo.
Together with the pots and the pans.
Oh,
all together singing in the kitchen. All together singing in the kitchen. All together singing in the kitchen. Together with the pots and the pans.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I first found out about David Rovix recently when I went looking for a song about Occupy Wall Street to accompany a recent episode of this show. I found his song, Occupy Wall Street. When I went to his website, I realized he's a wonderful musician in the long tradition of topical singer-songwriters like Phil Oakes, Tom Paxton, Holly Near, and, of course, Pete Seeger. Rovix has written over 200 songs, and you'll hear a few of them today. He also writes a blog, Songwriter's Notebook, and contributes essays to Counterpunch and other venues. Rovix is currently on tour throughout the U.S. and Canada, but he makes his home in Portland, Oregon. Well, David Rovix, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Good to be there.
I came across your work through Occupy Wall Street. I was looking around for songs about it, kind of Googled things, and your name came up, and some of your songs came up. You have a website called Songs of Social Significance. Tell us a little bit about this website, about yourself, about the work that you do as a musician.
Well, I've been traveling and playing, you know, writing songs and performing around a number of different countries for about, oh, I guess 20 years now. And I mostly write songs about current events and historical events and what they call topical songs about what's happening in the world now and in the past. And so, you know, that tends to sort of differentiate me from a lot of other songwriters these days, because it's not so fashionable to write about these subjects, you know, since the music industry came along.
Yeah.
And decided what was fashionable.
Well, it used to be a lot more fashionable. I mean, there was Bob Dylan, there was Pete Seeger, there was Joan Baez when I was growing up. You know, the music industry had no trouble putting out that kind of music. What's happened?
I think a big one of the big things that happened was in the 60s and 70s, there were independent FM radio stations that were, even though they were not like community stations, they had advertising and stuff, but they were owned by individuals who could program, you know, the way they wanted to. And so it wasn't necessarily a democratic way to run the media, but it was much more diverse and much more local media, and they could decide what they wanted to play. And also, you know, there was a huge mass movement at the time throughout the 60s and early 70s, and so there was sort of a much more ready kind of market for that kind of music. But I think a lot of it has to do with the independence of the music industry and radio back then compared to now, where it's like all dominated by Clear Channel and three record companies.
So that we've had actually censorship because of the corporate takeover of the radio media is what you're saying.
I think that's a big part of it, but I think there's a lot of other things. Like, to some extent, it's kind of blatant in terms of the concentration of the media by just a very small number of energy companies. But there's also been a nuance to it. I think even before the 60s, the music industry tended towards trying to appeal to the lowest common denominator and not to have divisive music that, you know, wouldn't be enjoyed by their Republican listeners. You know, I mean, they want to sell records, and so I think for a long time they've tended to shy away from political material. So even though they embraced it to some extent in the 60s, but to some extent now, I mean, there are artists that are very political that are on major labels. You know, but the tendency has always been to shy away from that kind of stuff in order to, you know, not offend people and to sell more records. And also because I think, you know, a lot of these people that run these companies have a political agenda and a political perspective, and it tends not to be very progressive.
I'll say. Now, you just said something, the takeover by energy companies. Do you mean literally energy companies, the takeover of the media?
Yeah, like General Electric and Westinghouse and others are huge owners of media. Like NBC. NBC is owned by General Electric, which is a, you know, company that makes nuclear missiles and nuclear power plants as well as toasters.
And so now about you, you grew up in a family of classical musicians. What drove you in this direction? This kind of tradition of, I mean, I think we could call it kind of the Tom Paxton folk song tradition. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely it's in that tradition. I mean, I've definitely been more influenced by punk rock than Tom Paxton was, but but it is very much in that tradition of topical music. I guess my parents are both classical musicians, but I played classical music as a kid, but I got into other kinds of music as a teenager, you know, partly that was also due to my parents' influence, because they introduced me to Pete Seeger, but I got into all sorts of other music, rock and roll and bluegrass and all sorts of traditional music from different places, as, you know, sort of as in my late teens. It was just partly a random just discovery of other music other than classical music, and then it was also, you know, partly influenced by different circumstances, moving to the Bay Area as a teenager, and then sort of not with the intention of discovering, you know, sort of topical music traditions, but that certainly was part of what happened. I grew up in the suburbs in Connecticut, and things were culturally a bit more limited than in San Francisco or Boston or someplace like that.
Mm. You know, I would imagine that one issue around writing topical music, political music, is how do you balance, you know, the aesthetic and the political? How do you make sure you're not kind of preaching?
Basically, what always has to come first, in my opinion, is the songwriting. And it has to be, you have to be writing in a way that is convincing, like to have a voice that really works for that song, and to always be paying very close attention to every word in a song and where it fits in. And the music, of course, as well, has to be the vehicle that carries those lyrics where they are trying to go. And I mean, that it's all absolutely vital, but that's true for any kind of songwriting or any kind of writing, for that matter. I mean, the style is always as important as content. And this is, you know, unfortunately something that is a lesson that's lost on a lot of political-oriented songwriters out there who you know, over the decades, who tend to think that as long as they have something to say, it doesn't matter how they say it. But you know, and that's probably generally true of the sort of folk music scene and a lot of other music scenes. Generally, there's always been, you know, from people like Pete Seeger, a real, you know, good encouragement for anybody to do it. You know, pick up a guitar, play a few chords, you can do it. You know, it's music of the people, and that's all great. But, of course, you know, there's quality music, and there's music that is not well written, you know, there's lots of both, but the style is absolutely important.
The climate talks at Durban just ended with what can only be called a pusillanimous agreement that will get the world nowhere near the cuts in emissions that are needed. David Rovics has written about climate change, including his powerful song about Hurricane Katrina, which you'll hear later. I asked him about it.
I'm actually on record for, I think, a number of different times, and I certainly remember talking about it a lot before, for years before Katrina destroyed New Orleans. I was saying what other people were saying, that, you know, maybe once a Category 5 hurricane hits New Orleans, maybe once New Orleans gets destroyed, then people are going to wake up to the reality of climate change. And of course, unfortunately, that it actually happened. And then, policies have continued to suck in terms of our government and how it's not dealing with the problem, you know. But I have been aware of climate change for a long time, and it's certainly one of the biggest challenges of our, you know, species right now, and we're failing to deal with it. I mean, other countries are dealing with it to a much better extent. You know, I mean, Germany is now running on 20% renewable, and they're set to beat all their targets for running most of the country on renewable energy, you know, whereas we're just polluting more every year here in the U.S., sadly.
Everybody knew that it could happen. The likelihood was clear. The future was coming. Now it's here. They had to fix the levees, 'cause otherwise they'd break. On one side was the city, above it was the lake. It was in the daily papers, in bold letters was the writ. What would happen when the big one hit? But every year they cut the funding just a little more, so they could give it to the army to fight their oil war. National Geographic and the Times-Picayune, they forecast the apocalypse, said it was coming soon. Preparations must be made, they said. Now is the time. It was years ago, they shouted. Inaction was a crime. They said the dikes must be improved and the wetlands must be saved. But Washington decided instead they should be paved, 'cause malls were more important than people's lives. So put some gold dust in your eyes and hope no storm arrives. New Orleans, New Orleans. And years of warning, no evacuation plan. It was just if the waters rose, get out if you can. There were no buses, no one chartered any trains. There was no plan to rescue all of those who would remain. All the people with no money, all the people with no wheels, all of those who couldn't hotwire one that they could steal. Thousands and thousands of people abandoned by the state, abandoned by their country, just left to meet their fate. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. ¶¶ their attics, an army of the poor, an army of the destitute who couldn't get away. And the world will remember those sad and awful days when people shouted from their houses, dying on their roofs. When people came to find them, they were turned back by the troops. They died there with no water. They died there in the heat. They were shot down by the soldiers for trying to find some food to eat. New Orleans, New Orleans, New Orleans. Now the city is in ruins, a massive toxic sea scattered through the nation. Half a million refugees, here we are. In the richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth, where oil is the king, where global warming is ignored, where the very end of life is the place we're heading towards, where it's more than just a metaphor, the flooding of the dike. And if we don't stop this madness, the whole world will be like New Orleans.
David Rovick singing his song about Hurricane Katrina, entitled New Orleans. Rovick writes what he calls songs of social significance. You can listen to and download them for free at davidrovick.com. We'll link to his site at writersvoice.net. Here's his song, Tax the Rich.
500 or so rich men in the Congress are engaged in some most serious debate, along with a few thousand lobbyists. They will now decide the world's fate. They say we're running out of dough, and the people all must take another hit. Well, there are some things that I know, and what they're saying is, I am not a mathematician, but one doesn't have to be too deft to see if 1% of us owns half the wealth. That leaves 99% to share what's left. And then if 60 cents on each tax dollar is buying bombs to blow the planet into bits, then I think we need to grab them by the collar and patiently explain to them that that's tax the rich, tax the rich. Close the loopholes so none of them can fudge it. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home, and eliminate the military budget. They say we cannot pay for health care, nor for decent schools to educate the kids. Sorry if you don't have shoes to wear, but this recession has just left us in the skids. They say we can't afford those windmills after all, so just stiffen up and show a little grit. And if climate change and poverty have gotten you down, just sing, oh say, can you see? Tax the rich, tax the rich. Close the loopholes so none of them can fudge it. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home, and eliminate the military budget.
That was David Rovick's song, Tax the Rich. Occupy Wall Street is what actually brought me to you. What were your feelings about Occupy Wall Street? How do you see this as an opportunity for your work?
Well, I think anytime there's some kind of a movement going on or some kind of an, even just an upswing in protest activity, you know, people like me definitely benefit and definitely get the chance to play our music to a more, to a wider, bigger, broader audience, you know, during times like that. And so that's certainly been, in terms of the effect on my career, it's certainly been, I've certainly been singing to a lot of people that had never heard my music before because of all my visits to Occupy sites. And then, of course, also whenever there's a movement happening, there's a lot more to write about and a lot more happening that's sort of interest. So there, that sort of goes into the whole pot too. You know, it inspires music and certainly inspires me to want to do more touring and more visiting to Occupy sites. It's been a wonderful couple of months with, you know, something happening everywhere. I just happened to have a tour already planned around the country that started the day before the first protest on Wall Street in September. And so then I was able to sort of combine visiting Occupy sites with the tour that I was already doing all over the U.S. and Canada. So it's been great timing.
So did you go down to Zuccotti Park, to Liberty Square in New York?
Yeah, I was there on September 17th, but I haven't been back since. The tour sort of started in New York, so I was there for the first protest, and then I was in D.C. when they started Occupy D.C., and then I played at lots of different Occupies, sometimes during the first few days when they were getting established in different cities, and other times after the police raided the place and took down all the tents, I mean, at various points in the lives of different occupations.
So you've been at an occupation when it was up and then after it was taken down?
Yeah, I mean, the occupations after the police have taken down the tents, what tends to happen is the general assemblies continue. You know, they just don't have a sort of physical presence there at night in some cases. You know, in some places, like in Cincinnati and in Chicago, people aren't even allowed to, you know, hang out in the parks at night. There's a curfew, so people walk around the park at night. Other places, like Minneapolis, they've been allowing people to spend the night in these parks, but not allowing people to set up tents. So it varies a lot from place to place, how the police and the authorities have been dealing with the issue of camping and how they've been dealing with, you know, the issue of people trying to exercise their First Amendment rights generally.
So how does it work if you're in a place where they don't allow amplification? Do people use the people's mic with your songs?
That doesn't work. the people's mic is great for meetings, but it's no good for music. But I've done different shows with amplification and other things just acoustically. And, you know, a lot of the places, like especially at the times I'm visiting, it's not like it, which is often in the middle of the night, there's not an overwhelmingly large crowd, so it's often easy enough to just do it acoustic. And then other situations, I've used sound systems. I have a little battery-powered amp that I've been traveling around with a bit on the West Coast here, but otherwise I've often sung at events through sound systems. The whole human mic thing gets a lot of attention, and it's a brilliant phenomenon. But and of course, it's the main way of communicating in New York City, where amplification is not allowed. But in many other cities, amplification is allowed, so it's not a problem in a lot of other places.
You have a number of songs that you've created around Occupy Wall Street. Am I correct about that?
Not really. I mean, it's just that I've written a lot of songs that are about Occupy Wall Street before Occupy Wall Street started, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I've been writing songs about the concentration of wealth and the, you know, the power and influence of the 1% for my entire songwriting career. So it's not like the theme is something new for me or for lots of other folks. So my song Tax the Rich, which is all about exactly what they're talking about and about the 1% and what they own and everything, I wrote that last spring. But certainly the Occupy Wall Street movement, you know, has been very much inspired by the Arab Spring, and I've already been writing songs about developments in the Arab world, you know, before the Occupy movement started as well. So I've got lots of material that is certainly directly related, but the only song that I've written since the Occupy movement started in the U.S. is the Occupy Wall Street, We're Gonna Stay Right Here.
Because this is where they buy the politicians. Because this is where power has its seat. Because 99% of us are suffering at the mercy of the madmen on this street. Because all of us are victims of class warfare being waged on us by the 1%. Because these greedy banksters rob the country, leaving us without the means to pay the rent. Because the last time that we had a decent government was about 1932. Because we the people are supposed to run this country, but instead it's all run by and for the few. Because now we know the rich do not pay taxes, but when they need a hand, it's us who bail them out. Because we suspected we lived in a plutocracy, but suddenly of late there is no doubt. So we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. Because both my parents lost their savings. Because I have never opened an account. Because the interest on my credit card just doubled, and now I can't pay the minimum amount. Because these budget cuts are just immoral, with our schools as overcrowded as they are. Because there are no buses where I live, but I can't afford to drive a car. Because so many of us don't have health insurance, the rest of us have it, but it sucks. Because the rich are flying in their private jets, while the rest of us are slogging through the muck. Because capitalism isn't working, this system has just failed to produce. Because the 1% are prospering, while the rest of us just suffer their abuse. So we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. Because it has been demonstrated amply that the winners are the ones who stick around. Because this world should belong to everyone, not just the banksters who had smashed it to the ground. Because we've noticed voting doesn't change things when the politicians are mostly millionaires. Because we're learning how to stand up like Tunisians, like they did in Tahrir Square. There a young man named Mohammed who was easy, struck a match that lit up all the earth. And all around the world the spell was broken, and a movement for the future was in birth. Because there's only so much that the rich can feed us before we figure out which side we're on. Because we've learned if we want our liberation, it will only come if we stay here till the rising of the dawn. So we're gonna stay right here. We're gonna stay right here. Because corporations are not people, and we can't just let them choose. Because if we leave our fate to them, then all of us will surely lose. Because the climate clock is ticking, and we can't just leave our world behind. Because corporate rule isn't working, and it's time for humans' hearts and minds. Because you can't take it with you,
because the rich just do not care. Because it doesn't matter how much you make, but how much you can share. Because these moments don't come often. Because we want truly to be free. Because we know what really matters. Something called society. So we're gonna stay right here.
That was David Rovix's song, Occupy Wall Street. You know, back in the civil rights movement, there were a lot of songs that people sang together. You know, you're doing a different kind of a thing, which is just as important. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this dual approach to protest songs. The kind, you know, let's say, like, We Shall Overcome, that people would sing together, versus the kind that you would create. Any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. Well, the songs that everybody sings together, there's a great power in everybody singing something together. Part of the thing about people singing together is a simple song that everybody can easily learn quickly. But so certain songs certainly lend themselves to being sung together, like We Shall Overcome is great, very, very simple lyric, very repetitive and very slow and very little rhythmic, you know, complexity. So it's very easy for lots of people to sing together. Other songs, like most of the songs that I write, or most of the songs that are sort of from this more kind of storytelling tradition, you know, sort of musical storytelling is kind of, you know, this guy, which is not a recent thing by any means, but, you know, songs that fall more into that kind of category are harder for lots of people to sing with, but a lot of the songs that I do, you know, and that other songwriters in this kind of tradition do, are actually easy for a lot of people to sing with, but the main catch there is whether people know the songs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, of course, one of the benefits of having so many protests and having so much media covering the protests back in the 60s was, you know, songs like We Shall Overcome, everybody learned them, so everybody knew them, you know, just like everybody knew the Beatles' Red Album or something. I mean, everybody learned these things were everywhere. You couldn't not learn these songs. But in the case of, you know, songs that are lesser known, there's the obstacle of people learning them in the first place. But once they do, you know, if they have really, doesn't take much musical ability to sing along with the chorus to, you know, most any song of mine, but it helps to actually know it before you come to the show or before you come to the protests. You know, of course, in some places there are actual crowds of people who all know the lyrics to my songs, but and can sing along with them, so, which works just fine. But yeah, it's certainly not the norm.
Well, Dave Rovix, I hope people will be singing along with your songs and listening to them for a very long time to come. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice, and we really appreciate the chance to also listen to some of the songs as we are doing today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Francesca.
David Rovix has written more than 200 songs. You can find links to listen to and download them for free at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.